Go.
Oh. Sound effects, people. Sound effects.
I can hear me echoing in your cans, so...
Yeah, I know.
I think you need to turn your can volume down a little bit.
Let's try that and see if that works. I've been having bad dreams.
I can't clink this Arrange Boom.
Arrange Boom? Is that a new mic arrangement you've got?
No, that's the... yeah. Instead of an orange tree. No, it's that Dutch beer that they're brewing under license here. I was walking back to the car at the end of work and I thought, I had this horrible thought, shit, I don't think there's any cold beer in the fridge. So, of course, I had to run to the bottle shop, bought a box of Arrange Boom because they were on special, got them home, went downstairs to the beer fridge. Of course there was beer. What the fuck was I thinking? I'm me. Past me knows that present me wants beer, but the fuck do we think we're doing here? What the fuck is this? What this is Balls After Dark, folks. And that's the first time we've back announced the name of the show in about a month as well.
Which everyone's been looking forward to seeing how angry you're going to be having listened to Radiohead.
I'm not angry, Beza.
Just disappointed.
Those are your words. It's been a short week.
That's what Ryan says to the kids. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed.
That's what he says to you, though, too.
True. So Should we start with bad dreams?
We're teasing that for the end of the show.
Bad dreams.
What's that bad, cap, all caps, bad, / dreams with an E? And we're not talking about the sort of bad dreams where you're nude doing an exam and you're failing and you're late and the bell's running and everyone's laughing at your small penis. Those sorts of dreams, you can keep to yourself because nobody is releasing those. Well, somebody might be releasing them, you know, Inception style, but no one's releasing them. So we, this is the second album from these guys. They're a bunch of four likely lads from Adelaide. We reviewed their first album November last year, about 18 months ago. We actually tweeted from the pod account a Friday flashback to that episode. It's actually a pretty good episode if you go back and listen to it. It has jokes. We used to be really good at this, and now we suck. Although
we've gotten worse, is that what you're saying?
We pretty much have, yeah. I think that's pretty clear. but it was interesting to see the things that we honed in on in terms of the album sound. And as you mentioned last week, you felt that they'd hadn't done a particularly flash job, or they'd made some interesting decisions, shall we say, about where they'd put the they'd really brought the lead singer's vocal up high in the mix and made it quite prominent. And I'd made the comment that it felt like they really could use the hand of an experienced producer to help guide the sound. Boy, am I stupid. Do you want to know why?
Was that?
So I did a little bit of research about who produced that first Bad Dreams album. There's a fellow by the name of Mark Opitz, who you might not know the name of, but you will know his output. Basically, every significant Australian band release of the 1980s was produced by this guy.
Yeah, that name does ring a bell with me.
So he started with, he was a protege of Vander and Young. He started at Albert's.
He did an
AC/DC album in the late 70s. He did all of Chisel's early 80s releases. All of the Angels' early 80s releases. He did all the In Excess's 90s releases. He did the Hoodoo Gurus. He did the Divinals. If it was an Australian fucking rock album in the 80s, he fucking made it. Which is kind of A, duh, and B, that's why this thing sounds like, that's why that first album sounded like a melange of Chisel and the Angels. And interestingly, the Choir Boys weren't on that list, but the Choir Boys were done, were on the label that he was helming. So he was kind of chief producer A&R dude for Mushroom in the time when the Choir Boys were being produced, not by him, but you could assume it was kind of to his template. So that's kind of why that sound came through. He's in charge again for this album, which is, I think, is why a lot of the same production choices have been made. And in fact, you could argue that it almost felt like they doubled down on
Would you like to hear a little story that I think sums up this album perfectly? Because this album made me feel a particular way. So I listened to this album on the way home.
Was it a way that made you feel bad or you feel safe?
No.
Okay.
I was listening to this album on the way home and I'm I'm driving through Beenleigh, which, you know, as everyone would know, is on the more bogan side of areas.
It's on brand.
And yes, very on brand. And I was driving past the local tavern and they had one of those digital...
The famous Beenleigh Tavern, yes.
One of those digital signs out the front. And on that sign flashed up, 6 Southern Comfort and Coke for $10. And I went, oh, that sounds good. And almost turned in for fucking 6 Southern Comfort and Cokes. This album makes me feel like I should be wearing a blue singlet, beating my children a little bit, and smoking Winnie Blues.
And you know what the funny thing is?
And I don't like it.
Well, you know the funny thing about it is that originally when they first started out, they did a film clip which just involved them going out to a paddock and doing fucking burnouts and jumping trail bikes and starting fires and getting pissed. And they got accused by some people of saying, you're just taking the piss out of bogans for cheap laughs. You know, this is pathetic. You know, this is kind of pissant social commentary. And they were like, no, this is just what we like to do. No, this is what we like to do. So that was that was where they were in 2013. In 2017, they're recording songs about how they hate bogan culture and they hate racism and they hate the flag and Donald Trump and they're against all of that. And there's all these studded through their lyrics are anti-heroes. The bad guys are these exactly the sort of dudes you're talking about. They're really, lyrically, they're digging right into this sort of bogan culture that they... that kind of brought them to here to start with. It's kind of like pub rock will eat itself. It's that part of it I find really interesting in that they've that they're kind of going after the pisshead bogan racist culture that you could argue they seem to have come from. I mean, there were elements of that in the first album. But as we said, I mean, it's exactly the same production aesthetic as last album. Even the same design. I mean, if the front cover is the same kind of rough as guts, black and white dude look. I think the songwriting's better. I think the actual songs are better than they were on Dogs at Bay. There are some hits and some misses, but I do think that doubling down on the lead singer's shtick, because he's really leaning into that dissolute, bogan, kind of aesthetic. And what made me think was that Opeth's, most of the albums that this guy produced in the 80s, most of the bands he was working with were bands that, when you think of them, their identity is completely tied up with their lead singer. The band was driven by the personality of the lead singer, both in terms of on stage and in terms of their voice's personality, like Chrissy Amphlett, Doc Neeson, Jimmy Barnes, obviously, Michael Hutchence, because he was doing it by the time he was working with NXS, they were a bit further along in their career. I think he's trying to manufacture this dude, whose name is Ben. I've never heard of him. I'm not sure if he's renowned as having a fantastic stage presence. This might be an Albion Lovedown question. And I noticed retweeted a positive review of this album with a kind of an affirmatory kind of this is good kind of comment. So I think he's generally generally positive about it. I should say I'm not sure if the lead singer is renowned as being a particularly strident front man in the way of those acts of the past. But I feel I'm not sure if. There's two things I'm not sure about. Well, there's many things I'm not sure about. I'm not sure if when part of the job of a producer is to try and tease out the personality of the band and put that on tape. With bands like the Divinyls and like NXS and Chisel and the Angels, was that lead singer personality driven something that existed before and he teased it out, or was he trying to lead with that? Was it because of his production that they teased that out? I don't think it's the second one. And I think he's trying to do that with this band. I think it feels a little bit forced, particularly in that first track where it just seems very, it seems like an affectation how kind of ragged and bedraggled and dissolute the lead vocal actually is. because he's got some really interesting stuff to say. And when he chooses to sing, he sings well. I thought about this album a lot.
I can't remember any instances of him singing well. I thought they really doubled down on that hymn high and the vocal mix, and like the first album, I actually think the music was a bit better, more appealing to me anyway. I don't know whether better is the right word.
Yeah, I disagree with that because I think the songwriting's actually, I think that's one thing that's improved with them being on tour. I think their songwriting chops are better.
But all I could hear was his vocal. It was just like a nail going through my brain the whole time.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to get around. And we thought that was an accident, but no, that's actually a choice. It's a deliberate choice they made in the first album, and it's a deliberate choice they've doubled down on the second album. I'd be interested to see them live, but I find it intrusive. I found the way that he carried on, if you like, didn't add as much to it as I kind of hoped it would. You know, by trying to force a personality onto the band with those elements, it wasn't really working for me. And I, having said all that, I like the album. I like the songs. I don't know how much I like it because of that, because of the reservations I have about the way the vocal, the same way that you've got reservations about the vocal. I think your reservations are deeper and last the whole drink through, whereas.
And the funny thing is like I've got a Choir Boys album on my classic album shortlist, like, you know, and this is really in that Choir Boys. You could put this and the Choir Boys next to each other, and you would go, okay, they came from the same space. You know, maybe not culturally, but musically.
No, I think culturally, yeah, and I would also say you could argue they're both second wave. You know, they're both. I mean, the primary text, if you like, is the late 70s, early 80s bands like your AC/DC, Chisel, fucking Angels, that sort of those bands that came out of Albert Studios, if you like.
Yeah,
and the Choir Boys were after that. They were not in the same way that Bush and Live were post grunge fucking. Arrivists.
Wannabes, yeah.
Yeah, they were clearly strap-ons, as a friend of mine used to refer to people who, you know, arrived late and joined in with the bandwagon. They were strap-ons. You certainly couldn't say that about Bad Dreams because it's been 30 years since this shit was cutting edge. But clearly by getting the guy who used to do the stuff, and he's, you know, pretty much in retirement now, so it's clearly... It's a choice that was made to get him involved, and he made some choices that were, you're going to get the early 80s Angel starter kit on this, and that's exactly what he got.
That's the thing. If you get him, you want to sound like this. It's not an accident. That's what you're going for.
And I wonder what they would sound like if they didn't get him. If you got, say, I mean, when we first reviewed this album, we sort of said, well. He's got a vocal presence that's not dissimilar to, say, early Phil Jamison. And we reviewed that engagingly fucking starter kit first Grinspoon album where Phil Jamo is ragged as and really doesn't know what he's doing with his voice. And that's part of the appeal of it, is that it's raw as fuck. If they'd done a production aesthetic, it was much more kind of post-grunge. Whether the album would have been better or different, or how that would have changed things.
Like Paul Mack or, you know, someone with a more pop aesthetic.
Danger Mouse. Danger Mouse fucks up your favorite music.
Mm. I like Broken Bells.
He fucked up the Black Keys, so he can go fuck himself.
Yeah. So what did you think of...
The Black Angels.
The Black Angels death
it's
song.
Funny we say the Black Keys because there was some of that did sound a little bit like the Black Keys had dropped a bunch of LSD. The Black Angels are not the Black Opinions Matter Month version of the Angels. Shouts to Black Opinion, Black Opinions Matter, Black Opinions Matter Mondays, which is one of the old True Hoop podcasts, which are going to be reborn under a different name, which is lovely to see in here. Of course, this is sport podcast content. As I said, this was less a Discover Weekly thing, although I think one of the tracks did pop up in Discover Weekly as a repeated exposure to some of the tracks on World Surf League coverage. So they're named after a Velvet Underground song, which is the Velvet Underground song is literally the Black Angels' death song, which makes you wonder why it's taken them five albums to get to Death Song as an album title. The album cover itself looks like somebody's done Spirograph with fucking red and blue calligraphy pens. So what we're getting to is that they're clearly aiming for a sort of a psychedelia area.
It definitely has a lot more. It's got a lot of space to breathe. It's got a bit of ambience to it.
One of the comps for this band I noticed on Spotify was Black Mountain, which is probably how they ended up in my Spotify.
Because
they popped in there.
But it's not a patch on them.
Well, it's a different sort of sound.
It's a lot more chilled.
So
the first time I listened to this, I listened to it straight after Black Dreams. Bad Dreams.
Black Dreams. And by the way, I looked at my my fucking list of bands to come, and like there's five or six of them that are Black something.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, could we get some new fucking band names, dudes?
That I listened to a very, very funny podcast today from the guys.
It's the Balls Podcast.
Do you listen to that podcast, the Giant Dwarf guys?
No, I follow them all on Twitter, and that makes me want to punch them all in the head.
Story time. This guy was working at an Apple store, and when they had that, you could pay, I think it was $150, and get as many one-on-one training sessions with Apple people on whatever software you wanted to get training on. And so this guy helped this 70-year-old woman write her erotic novel, which was called, I can't remember the name of it, but after he left Apple and a couple of years later, he looked it up on his Kindle store and the name of the book, there was six different versions of that book with that name, like sort of cheap erotic knockoff thrillers with that name. And that's what some of these band and album names. I suppose there's only so many names in the world, isn't there?
Well, yeah, but it's like there's a fucking name recompiler, like Black Angels and Death such and such. But I'm a bit like the Bad Dreams album. I like this album, but I'm not sure how much I like this album.
So I listened to it straight after Bad Dreams, and I was like, oh, this is really enjoyable. And then it was one of those albums where I go, I'm gonna listen to Death Song again, and I was like, "What was the favorite? What song did I like off that album? What jumped out at me that I really liked?" And I was like, "Nope, I can sort of have general thoughts on what the sound's like, but none of the songs grab me."
So it's not sticking in there. That's interesting. I'm not on that page with you. I have to say, I really like I'd Kill For It. Comanche Moon was the one that they were plugging on. They were using for the louder parts of World Surf League montages. Hunt Me Down's kind of cool. Life Song's a little bit okay, Computer. It makes you feel like you want to top yourself, but I enjoyed this album as much as I'd hoped to, I guess. You know, I didn't have any great hopes or plans. I just thought, oh, that's a cool track. I might throw that in. We'll see how it goes. And yeah, I enjoyed this album.
I've got
a lot less to say about it than Bad Dreams, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, like, I've been, unless it's something that I know that I don't like, I've been throwing it into a playlist and going back a couple of weeks later and just having a listen and sort of seeing what I think once it's marinated a bit. I'm trying to do my end of year list a bit more thoroughly this year.
You don't want to cram for it at the end of the year like a fucking...
Yeah, I want to come back to, you know, I want to come back to that Spoon album in 3 months. Like, I'm not going to listen to that Spoon album now for 3 months and come back and see whether I'm as high on the first half of the album and as down on the second half of the album as I am at the moment. But I've just got no lasting impression of this album from the three or four times I've listened to it, and I just don't know whether that's, you know, if it can't grab. But then, look, I've got albums that I absolutely love that I bought from a shop, listened to three or four times, just went, ah, this is crap. And then because I had physically bought the CD, eventually got around to listening to again and went, oh, actually, there's something in that, and found something in an album much later after I'd bought it.
So I don't have albums like that. All of my albums are like that. I would always buy a CD, listen to it once, go, set it aside, come back to it a couple of months later and go, fuck, this is awesome. Yeah. I love it. It's great. And it's kind of, I don't know. And that's why this is quite a different, what a departure from the way that my mind works. But I think on both of these albums, I'm going to have to come back to later. I don't think they're not top five. And I don't, they don't think they're top 10, but I know that I'm more positive. There's much more positive about it than negative in terms of the songs on there. And some of the tracks on this album I really like. I really like that kind of fucked up 60s psychedelia / grunge sound that they were playing with.
Look, I love the sound. I just none of the songs grab me. Like, at no point of the album did I want to turn it off. It's just nothing grabbed me. Yeah, I don't know. That Bad Dreams album, though, that's going in the bin. No, I'm not a fan of that one. So, all right, shall we approach the topic of the classic album? Are you going to be silent for 20 minutes now? Am I just going
to
talk?
Well, you need to tell us why this is a classic album.
Okay, so Radiohead's OK Computer, but I also wanted to throw in there...
No. Why is OK Computer a classic album?
Because it's a very... Because I find it really interesting, even after 20 years. I think it's a great blend of sort of what they were good at before the experimentation took over. Like, it's the bridge between what they wanted to do experimentally and what they were good at before, because they were sort of good at, I don't know whether you'd call it straight down the line rock, but it was definitely more conventional sort of rock and roll music. And then they
we should certainly talk about the Bends as a side note at towards the end of it.
Yeah.
I think we need to, because OK Computer seems to be a tipping point in Radiohead history that is incredibly important for everything that followed.
Mm. So I think they obviously, you know, they did two sort of more straight down the line rock albums, Pablo Honey and the Bends.
I think even at the time they didn't fit into boxes, because you couldn't call them grunge.
No.
They weren't grunge and they weren't Britpop. They didn't fit in any of the, and those were in those days. I was just going to shut up and let you talk, but anyway.
No. You're more the historian who can fit stuff into boxes than
that's
I can.
Kind of that's kind of our aesthetic. I'm the amateur music historian. You're the dude who actually ran fucking gigs. So you've got it's kind of like practical knowledge versus theoretical knowledge. But they were always outside. I mean, when Creep was big off Pablo Honey, people said, oh, they're a grunge band like Nirvana. But Pablo Honey is not a grunge album. It's got elements of that. It's got bits of
that. That song's a complete outlier of everything else that they do.
I know. Well, there is some other stuff a bit like that. But there's bits of early Britpop, because this was kind of very early Britpop in terms of the Blur, Oasis kind of era, that sort of stuff. There's bits of that Manchester kind of sound as well. But it still doesn't match anything else that was going on at the time. And then you take Pablo Honey and you compare it to the Bends, and Pablo Honey the sound evolves there. And Pablo Honey and the Bends don't sound like OK Computer and so on and so forth.
Mm. Well, and I think they got to Kid A, and then after Kid A, they just went, their sound
they just
doesn't
went,
really they, change. Like, you know, it's just weird shit. So we were talking
before about
that.
It's just sad shit, really, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, but it's not even. I don't think it's good. But the thing is,
sad can mean a lot of things. Sad could mean disappointing, and sad could mean depressing. And I think late era Radiohead ticks all those boxes.
Well, and then there's the fact of the way the band sort of acts and
conducts itself. And that definitely started in the making of this album, because that was almost like, when you and I had the, I think when you live through the production of an album, like when you hear about the news breaking on the internet about, oh, the latest weird thing the band's done, when it happens in real time when you were growing up, because we were like fucking 19, 20, 21. This album
was sort of 21, I think, we would have been when this came out.
Yeah, because it's 20 years ago.
We would have been 19.
They're talking about doing, they're mysteriously alluding to the possibility of doing a 20-year anniversary. They think they're the fucking KLF or something. But that's 20 years.
So I'll just finish to say
the gap between the Bends and OK Computer in my head is like 5 years. It's two.
Yeah, which is amazing. When you listen to those albums back to back like I did this afternoon.
Yeah.
The progression is very, very quick. Well, and it'd be interesting.
Not a progression, it's a complete discontinuation. It's a total change.
It'd be interesting to know the band politics in this. Like, well, was it all of them going for a completely different sound? Because I actually think that all of the sounds, like the drumming, the bass, the guitar, and the vocals, are all pushing the envelope in OK Computer from the Bends. It's not like it's just the vocals and the guitar pushing the envelope and the bass and the drums are pretty much the same. They're all sort of doing something a little bit twisted, a little bit different.
They're also structurally and functionally completely different songwriting.
Yep.
It is a very different song structure. There's a very particular plan. This is music as art installation. Not music as popular culture touchstone that we sell in shops. You might not remember this stuff, but there was a lot in the music press at the time about how they'd gone and made it, and it actually got parodied in the liner notes for Tism's www.tism.wanker.com album, which was a classic a few years ago, because they'd wrote the liner notes were this long account from the allegedly by the pen of the head of Shock Records, saying that was the history of this album being made. And it was basically the long story short, the head of the record label was getting more and more worried about Tism dabbling with dangerous substances like alienation and ennui and what, middle-class angst. And they were retreating to their inner suburban apartments to write songs about themselves. And it was a parody of the process that had famously underpinned the writing of OK Computer, which was
this is the thing that they were really
white middle class and sad about society.
This is the thing that I think why I still like this album probably a lot more than you do is I don't remember that stuff, and B, I've completely fucking shut out late era Radiohead, their politics, the way they do things, their media, everything. I only really listen to this album as a piece of music. All that other stuff around it and around the band, I just don't give a fuck about. I'm only interested in this as a piece of music. And I still think, with two tracks aside, I think there's two tracks that should have... One track should have definitely not fucking made the cut, and the other track just grinds on me a bit after a while. It's just a fucking ripper piece of music. I just think it's just so well. And that's the thing that shit me about that last Radiohead album is it was poorly constructed. What the fuck were they trying to do? This has a plan. Every song feels like it's got a plan, what they're trying to do musically, what they're trying to do with the mix. Everything sounds like it's got a place. And it's interesting. I don't think later Radiohead that does that. I think they're just trying to be weird without actually trying to do the fucking work.
Do you find it enjoyable?
Yes. Love this album. Love listening to this album. It's fucking fantastic. All of it. The drumming is awesome. The bass lines are awesome. The guitar is interesting. They're using his vocal as an instrument, not as a fucking sledgehammer to fucking beat you over the head with, because he's got the sort of voice you can't, like talking about that Bad Dream stuff, you can't have Tom York's voice too high in the mix. If it's too high, this music sounds like shit. And the fact is, some of the times the guitars come back in, they actually drown him out, or the drums will drown him out. And that's exactly the way that you should use his vocal.
Do you notice the difference in the way that he uses his vocal in this album compared to the Benz?
Yeah.
He's really pushing that. And ironically, it is a bit like the way Bad Dreams' old mate, whose name escapes me, we'll probably never know, uses his voice, is that he's using it for effect. He's using it to try and depict this broken, ragged... I mean, Karma Police is a perfect example of that. You know, he's clearly somebody who's on the edge of his psychological tether. He is... And that's kind of where this whole album sits, on the edge of... On the edge of, not insanity, but on the edge of humanity.
When I sat down and tried to decide, like, I thought I really need to decide which album I like more, this or the Benz. The Benz has some fucking really good songs, but it's actually the guitar in OK Computer that makes me pick this album, because the guitar in the Benz is pretty straight down the line. Like, it's not that interesting.
I wouldn't agree with that.
Oh, not necessarily the playing of it. Like, I think it's really well played. I just don't know whether it's, I don't know whether he's pushing himself. This feels like a guy that's, you know, like music that really is pushing himself to express what he's trying to do. In saying that, I think the Benz probably has a couple of singles that are better than the singles in OK Computer. But I think as an album, OK Computer holds up better.
Cool. You done?
I need to talk
to you about why I have such a strong visceral reaction against this album.
Sure.
It makes me want to kill myself. And I don't like wanting to kill myself.
No, that's probably a good thing.
And
that's
survival mechanism. I've always wondered, I should point out, there isn't a lot in my voice which is indicating I'm joking here, and there shouldn't be. This album is deliberately, properly, intentionally miserable and depressing and very, very difficult to enjoy. And I mean enjoy in the way that the words enjoy has the word joy in it. There's no joy in this album. And I've never understood why people like listening to music which is deliberately upsetting. And I worked out after many years, it's because these people aren't mentally ill. And I would love to have that privilege.
Yeah.
I don't like this album.
Yeah, like we've talked before about the difference between you and me, how, like, I like an album that makes me feel a bit sad or a little bit, like this album sort of makes me look back in upon myself, like focus back in on myself. And I'm not a very self-involved person. So that feeling is probably a little bit good for me. But I completely understand what you're saying. If you were a person that liked music to make you feel positive things, then this is not a good album.
No, this is not an album. If you don't like feeling really bleak, this is a bad album. This is a really bad. And I've always hated this album. Always. From the moment I listened. And it's taken me 20 years to figure out what the problem with this album was, because I always felt the problem was me. And it kind of is, but it kind of isn't. Because it's not just the problem. It was always, you don't have an intellectual enough musical palate to not appreciate Radiohead. I know exactly what they're doing. And in fact, I think you set aside all the politics and the bullshit. If you'd listened to the lyrics, you realize you can't do that. The lyrics of the entire fucking thing are like a year 10 art installation level fake deep. We're all battery hens in cages, man, on antibiotics is the message of fitter, deeper. What is it? Fitter, stronger, healthier, happier? Like that stuff's irritating, that kind of thunderingly base level.
Earnest.
Yeah, earnest, exactly. That kind of, and that was the kind of white middle class angst shit that Tism were parodying. But you know, I've got technical problems with it. Like, I don't like what they've done with Tom's voice. I think it's fucking annoying. In the same way that you get irritated with all the vocalists that you don't like, I don't like what Tom did with his voice in OK Computer compared to the first two albums.
I think this is the tipping point.
I think they're beyond the tipping point. I think the tipping point was 96. I think this is late era Radiohead as far as I'm concerned. Everything else was like this.
From Kid A on, he became bigger than the band, and his voice was the biggest thing in the band. I find this is at least down in the mix.
He didn't even have Mark Opitz as his producer.
But I find it fascinating that you're self-evolved enough to understand, you know, that a particular style of music has an effect on you that you don't enjoy.
Well, no, it's more that this album is almost like it's been crafted to elicit that feeling. Every song is incredibly miserable and joyless. It's full of miserable, joyless. This album was a difficult album for me to get through. The only positive thing I did was the first time I listened to it this week was during the Clippers game.
And, it's the perfect soundtrack for the Clippers.
Desperate, pointless, asphyxiating death of the Clippers. It was like the film clip to No Surprises. That's exactly what it was. It was like a film clip to that album.
That was basically the only thing that didn't make me go out
and walking under a bus. I shouldn't use terms like that flippantly because, you know, mental health is a real thing, and I don't want anyone to think that I was in danger of self harming. I know that we made a joke about that last week, but I'm at a stage of my mental health evolution that I'm aware enough of the triggers that I have and the ways that I can manage my way around my life without getting into anxiety and depression triggers that will have me in a hole most of the time. So I don't want anyone to get the impression that I was, you know, catatonic for the day after listening to the album, but it does actually take me some. When I listened to that album, it took me some time to get out of the hole that the album had put me in, just because it's so oppressively joyless.
And look, I understand that.
And there are other people, and I've always been interested in the psychology of people who aren't like that. Who are the same people who are big Nirvana fans, you know, like of the second Nirvana album, which is brutally nihilistic. It's incredibly sad. You know, it's you're deep inside the head of someone who's properly fucked up. And I really couldn't take to that album at all. But lots of people liked it. And I never really understood what the disconnect was. And I think, ironically, it's the process of having to listen to this album again that's crystallized in my head.
Yeah. And like, I understand that I'm incredibly lucky that my brain is wired that I can enjoy the feelings of...
Check your mental health privilege, bro.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, but like, I can listen to this album and enjoy the way it makes... I like feeling melancholy every now and again. And movies, TV shows, or music, I can use that to make myself feel that way without having any damaging effects on myself. But I understand I'm pretty lucky to be able to do that as a choice, not as something that just fucking crushes me. So,
So shouts to anybody who's going through some shit. Because we are thinking about you.
Get help. Don't listen to Radiohead.
Or just, well, find the right context to listen to Radiohead. You know, I mean, there's always the right context. But I've always got into music and art as a pick me up, as an injection of joy, as a release, as a relief, not as a, not as the opposite. So that's why I've tended to graduate away from bands like this. And of course, the other thing about you have to say about OK Computer is that it was the point at which all of these other bands listened to it and either went, I'm going to copy the loud stuff, Muse, or I'm going to copy the sad shit, the Verve and Coldplay. But we can't blame Radiohead for the bands that they inspired, because then we'd have to blame you too for inspiring Radiohead. Because there is stuff on, like, there was some stuff in the back catalogue of, particularly those first three albums, and I thought, this is you too.
Yeah,
this is
I had
so
exactly
you too.
Listening to the Bends this afternoon, I was like, man, this could be off Rattle and Hum or Actung. This is so classic U2.
I think Actung is probably the, because Rattle and Hum was almost like a theme album.
More
even
of
that it was that kind of rhythm and blues. So one good thing about this process is that I got to understand why I have such a reaction against this album. The other good thing was that it reintroduced me to the Bends, which is a really, really solid mid-90s period indie rock album. It's really good at what it purports to do, you know, and that's what makes the light switch flick between very solid indie rock album of 1995 to album that's designed to make you feel like shit, 1997, is such a sea change, such a massive discontinuation point. It's like a massive fault line that rips through it. There's more joy in it. I think Tom's vocal is more consistently pitched. I'm not going to apologize for the fact that it's, you could argue it's more poppy. I don't care. I enjoy it more.
No, it made me happy.
I think,
again, early Radiohead, they had an idea of what they were trying to do. Like, their songs were crafted. They had a point of, like, Fake Plastic Trees is a fucking awesome pop song. It is a really good pop song.
I'd say it's the one that belongs the most on OK Computer. But
I don't know. I just think they had purpose back then, and I sort of hate Radiohead fanboys that just go, "Oh, the new stuff's fucking awesome." It's like, go back and listen to the first three albums, and then go back and listen to the last three at the, you know, straight afterwards. And
they're very different albums because they're a very different band, and I think the process of recording OK Computer changed them irrevocably.
Yes.
They couldn't do an album like the Bends now because they'd find it too derivative, man. You know, it'd be too generic. It'd be too formulaic. It'd be too, you know, too 1995.
But the funny thing is they've gone into a little bit like what U2 did, where U2 experimented for three or four albums and then found their formula and stuck to their formula. And that's what Radiohead have done. Their last couple of albums have been completely formulaic. It's just not a very good formula. Mm-hmm. Same as U2.
Yeah, which is a pity. I mean, excuse me while I burp. That's awful. I'm back to burp so much I forgot the point I was going to make. It was probably a good one.
Should we move on to some new music?
That was a good point I was going to make too, and it probably occurred to me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, that's the thing you should have put on the podcast.
I do all the editing, so you can't even go and edit it back in.
Oh, I can just write into the show notes like I did last week. The thing I said, guess what? We're completely wrong about the producer of the Bay Dreams album. Find out next week. You know, a producer would have helped those guys out quite a lot. The Bends, it's a good album. Oh, I was just going to say more about the my favourite track on OK Computer was always, and it was at the time, Paranoid Android. But the things I like about Paranoid Android as it is 6.5 minutes long, and they could have cut it at 3 minutes. There's actually a point, an out. There's a hard out at 3:30 that they could have taken. But then they just repeat the fucking song. With a long, you know, a long kind of dreary bit, and then they pick up the riff and go again. But all the things I like about Paranoid Android, there's like five songs in The Bends, including the title track, The Bends. But Just is my favourite Radiohead song. There's a whole bunch of others that I really like. And although if we're going to blame bands for the people who follow them, we have to blame High and Dry for inspiring that guy who made the song She's So High, because it's literally the same fucking song.
The same song.
So I think we should have a mashup of She's So High and Dry.
I think Airbag is my favourite song. I just think it just starts the album off so well. And I really like Exit Music. I think I just think it's a beautiful song. So, all right. I'm actually...
We're not going to find common ground, but at least it's not going to degenerate into a, I think you're a fucking cunt because you like this fucking pissant shit music.
Well, you do a much better job of articulating why you don't like something than I do, so I'm just like, I don't like it.
No, and look, you could turn it into a one sentence. It makes me feel like shit, and that's... I wouldn't accept that out of a personal relationship or a workplace relationship, so... Certainly not going to accept it out of a casual social relationship I have with a piece of music.
I think you will not be surprised at my first choice for the new music this week.
It's Radiohead's 20th anniversary re-release of OK Computer.
Well, make our job easier next week.
They should release a bunch of kind of a Little Britain remix album called Computer Says No.
It's your friend of mine, Mr. DJ Format.
The Format with the abdominal.
Yep. Been looking forward to this.
There's some music that will make you happy.
Oh,
there's
yes.
There's some music that just has a lot of joy to it.
There is two guys that are very self-aware of where they where they sit in the world.
How white and fucking British / Canadian they are.
Mm. And the other band is... Look, I like the first two Gorillaz albums, but I'm a little bit concerned looking at the guest vocalist on this album that I am not going to enjoy this one.
Would it make you feel better if you remember the fact that Liam tweeted about it saying that Noel had been ruined by the gobshite from Blur and that he was going to sort him out the next time he saw him? I think Noel is on the Gorillaz new album. That was Liam's review of the new Gorillaz album.
He's not credited on the new Gorillaz album, actually.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
I wonder what Liam was going on about then.
There's De La Soul, there's Grace Jones, there's Vince Staples.
So they're obviously, are they going for a R&B hip-hop kind of... I mean, I did hear the first song. It had an interesting film clip, but the song was kind of shit after. Perfectly honest.
So the guy that started with Gorillaz is Dan the Automator, who's one of my favorite all-time producers. I just don't think anything he touches is bad at all. And I think he just got bored with it and moved on to other stuff. So yeah, I don't know. Look, I'll give it a listen. I would have given it a listen anyway. It's not exactly inspiring confidence in me, though, all the guest vocalists, so...
Nor is it inspiring me that you keep picking old bands doing comeback albums that never turn out any good, because old bands doing comeback albums never does turn out any good.
Well, no, I've got a list of other stuff there, but I just thought, you know, it's a little bit like... They're not exactly in, like, you know, Gorillaz isn't exactly hip-hop, but...
Well, in the same way that Stereo MCs, you know... They happen to have a person doing raps out the front. It wasn't hip hop though. It was just,
you know, but Format is like the most self-deprecating lo-fi version, and Gorillaz is like this very high profile, 1,000 million guests. You know, it's sort of like complete different ends of the spectrum in roughly the same space. So I thought they'd go well together.
Yeah. It's an interesting combination.
Mm.
Combination.
So what do you got for the classic? Something happy, I'm guessing.
It is New Zealand Music Month. Ko haratua te marama puoro o Aotearoa. And that's the first time I'm ever going to do Te Reo on this podcast. So every May is New Zealand Music Month. This must be about the 15th or 17th annual. So I thought I'd try and find a classic album from the great history of New Zealand music. And the album I've chosen is an album by a band called Supergroove, who Ooh. Popped out in the early 90s with an album called Traction. Now, my clearest recollection of these guys is we're on a school trip down to Jindabyne, which is down near the New South Wales ski fields. And we're, of course, in northern New South Wales. So this takes... a day-long train and then an overnight bus to get there. And we're getting there early in the morning, and there must be some regional radio station on. And we're bleary-eyed, and they're playing just the FM. And It was one of Supergroove's singles. I think it was Can't Get Enough. And I just suddenly felt, I just had this clear recollection of seeing the sunrise and hearing this track and just feeling fucking alive, even though I was as close to jet lagged as you can be, having been on a train and a bus. What I didn't know at the time was that Supergroove were barely older than I was. They had their first single was released in 1992. They were 17. They'd just come out of school. When I was hearing them on a bus approaching Jindabyne, it was 1994. They were 19, and I was a year 11 kid. So it was remarkable how young they were when they were doing it. Now, their sound was kind of... basically, it was a style of music that they thought of, what will Bezo like? What if we had like party funk and hip hop all at once with lots of brass? And they looked and they saw that it was good. But these kids had grown up playing in high school bands, playing a lot of Blues Brothers covers and funk and soul and that sort of stuff. And then,
are they another fucking Wellington trumpet
band? No, they're from Auckland. Western Springs. They predate all those Wellington trumpet bands. But party funk hip hop put out one remarkable album that had like three or four top 10 New Zealand hits on it while under the age of 20. Toured the world, fell apart, reconstituted as kind of a boring post-grunge indie rock band that nobody wanted to hear from, and then just disappeared, and then reformed 25 years later and did winery tours. But one of their dudes did have a pretty good solo career as a rapper. That was Chafu. But
Yeah.
So he was Supergroove.
One of my flatmates who is from New Zealand and came over to Brisbane to do his PhD. So we were obviously both into Resin Dogs and Fat Freddy's and Salmonella. But yeah, he loved Shafu. That was one of his favourites. So
yeah, well, I had a mate who's actually went on to be in bands and things, but he was a big Chili Peppers fan and he was a big fan of this album. But I hadn't heard it all the way through for a lot of years, and then I found it in my girlfriend's CD collection. Now sleeping somewhere else in this house. Probably up to 15 years afterwards. So she's obviously got reasonable taste in music, but it's a good album. It's not all party bangers. It's not all fucking.
So which album are we going?
The album's Traction. Backspacer was the kind of post grunge, ill advised, she had light kind of thing that didn't really work out.
Cool. Sounds good.
And it did get some traction in the charts in those days.
Very nice. All right, sounds good.
Happy New Zealand Music Month to New Zealand music and months.
All right, Doc. Well, that's about it. I think this might be, wow, I think that After Dark might be longer than the sport. That is.
No, it's not. It's not. We went the full hour on the sport. On the sport. Depends whether you include the extra time after the whistle.
All right, Doc.
The time added on.
You enjoy New Zealand Music Month?
I will. I'll go and listen to some Supergroove because I can't get enough, can't get enough, no.
And I'll catch you next week.
Cheers, man.
See ya.